Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Coming up in this edition of Africa Link, Sudan opens a new oil field and we look at the troubled country's prospects in the oil business.
It has oil deposits, but more important, I think, that it continues to encourage the export of oil from South Sudan. And events in recent days along the border zone is very worrying.
Nigeria's wealthy and famous shun travelling up country for festivities for fear of being kidnapped.
Every artist will be scared of travelling because, one, you don't know what's going to happen. When they kidnap you, you might be hot and you might not come out alive.
Just two of the stories lined up for you in this edition of Africa Link. Hello, and do stay around for the next 25 minutes as we cover the African continent. I'm Crispin Mwakideo in Bonn.
Top story.
Going for black gold. North Sudan has opened its second new oil field in a week. Khartoum has been struggling to make up for the loss of billions of dollars in oil revenues since South Sudan separated from the North in July 2011. Sudan's official news agency, SUNA, reported that the field located in Hadida, on the border with East Darfur and South Kordofan, would produce 10,000 barrels of crude oil per day. However, analysts argue that the figure is unlikely to be the immediate output after startup. To give us an overview of Sudan's oil fields, here is Sarah Kamara and Abubakar Jallo with this fact box.
The new oil field in Hadida, North Sudan, is operated by Chinese oil company Petro Energy ENP. It is located on the border between East Darfur State and South Kordofan, the country's main oil-producing area. According to reports, the field will produce 10,000 barrels of crude per day, although that is unlikely to be the immediate output after startup.
In just over 2 weeks, Khartoum has opened two new oil fields. Last week, the government of Omar al-Bashir announced it will open its first new oil field in Al-Bazaya, on the western part of South Kordofan.
The South broke away from the North in July 2011. Juba took away two-thirds of the region's oil wealth, but processing and export facilities remain in North Sudan. Landlocked Juba depends on the North's pipeline and Red Sea port to export its crude. In January, the South shut off oil production after accusing Sudan of stealing its oil.
North Sudan lost most of its revenue after the 2011 referendum that subsequently gave the South full autonomy. The country's currency has plunged to record lows on the black market, and inflation has soared, reaching 46% in November. The lost crude oil accounted for most of Khartoum's export earnings and half of its fiscal revenues. The Khartoum government has promised to open more oil fields, as authorities say the new fields will increase oil production and enhance the country's economic situation.
Sudan's oil output for 2012 will likely not exceed 120,000 barrels per day, an International Monetary Fund staff report said in November. At the start of 2012, officials in Khartoum were targeting 180,000 barrels by the end of the year.
Sarah Kamara and Abubakar Jallo with that fact box on Sudan's oil. Before the inauguration of the Hadida oil field, inhabitants of East Darfur had threatened to disrupt work at the oil field unless the central government accepted it as being part of East Darfur. According to the Darfurians, the governor of North Kordofan, Mutasin Mergani Sakidin, had no right to claim the new oil field as part of North Kordofan. So what do the locals think about this newly launched oil field? I put that question to Alex Vines, head of the Africa program at Chatham House in London.
Clearly, they want to see benefits from it. This is a normal sort of situation, I think, where once there's an extractive industry beginning to operate, so local communities want to see what benefits they can gain from it. It's logical. My hope is that the Sudanese government manages this very, very carefully. Otherwise, it could be quite difficult in the future for production.
And when do you think the oil will start flowing from this new oil field?
That's difficult to say. It'll partly depend on how developed the infrastructure is to serve the oil field and the local politics of which we're discussing.
Where do you think Sudan get the funding from? We understand that the economy is really doing badly.
The economy of Sudan is doing badly. I think it will be able to find some loans from countries like China, maybe India or Malaysia. These countries have supported and invested in oil infrastructure in Sudan in the past. Those would be the most likely places, I think, that would provide some funding, maybe Iran also.
And will these new oil fields, Sudan has opened now two in a week, will they make any difference to Sudan's battered economy?
Well, no. I mean, the economy, as you put it, is very battered. It's been much traumatized by separation between North and South Sudan last year. To be honest, more important is still managing the border between South Sudan and Sudan and ensuring that the cross-border oil agreement actually operates and that the disputed border zone doesn't become violent. That's where I think Sudan will extract major taxes and royalties for using the pipeline that goes to Port Sudan.
So actually Sudan does not have enough crude oil deposits to shore up its economy.
It has oil deposits, but more important, I think, that it continues to encourage the export of oil from South Sudan. And events in recent days along the border zone is very worrying, with accusations of border violence emerging again.
The field is actually located on the border with East Darfur and South Kordofan. Both are very volatile regions in terms of security. Will that not affect production?
It will do. And again, you know, Kordofan and Darfur are part of a wider problem of core periphery issues that Sudan has suffered. That was a contributing factor in terms of separation with South Sudan. The Kordofan-Darfur issues are live ones, and the challenges for oil production again show why Khartoum needs to rethink how its relationships are with the constituent parts of what remains of Sudan.
Oil was and is still at the center of the dispute between North and South Sudan. Do you see this dispute being resolved soon?
No. On the 27th of December, yesterday, both sides accused each other of military incursions into disputed areas, which is a new setback to plans to resume the cross-border flow of oil. This is very worrying, I think. There have been allegations also that five people were killed when Sudanese planes bombed Kir Adim, which lies inside the 14-mile-wide strip of land claimed by both countries. So I don't think 2013 is going to be any more stable than 2012 has been.
Head of Africa Programme at Chatham House, Alex Vines, speaking to me from London.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
The Green Army Invasion. Food shortages are looming in Zambia as half of the country's 10 provinces have been invaded by a pest known as the armyworm. The tiny green caterpillars have already destroyed thousands of hectares of maize, the country's staple crop. Despite a bumper maize harvest, shortages in maize flour have already been reported and the prices are skyrocketing. Zambia's government, however, claim they have moved in to contain the looming disaster by providing seeds to the affected farmers. From Lusaka, Kathy Sikombe with more on the story.
Some farmers say the armyworms have eaten up all the maize that they planted for the 2012-2013 farming season. So they will have to start from scratch once again, but some of them do not have the means to replant the lost seed. About 40 districts, that's almost half the country, has been affected. Armyworms have invaded Copperbelt, Muchinga, Northern, Lusaka, Eastern, Southern and Central provinces. Farmers in those areas are very worried and are calling on government to act quickly and come up with a lasting solution. Beatrice Chanda, a commercial farmer in Chongwe, 50 kilometers east of the capital Lusaka, was one of those whose entire maize crop was ruined by the armyworm.
No, they really did damage my farm. They ate about 1.5 acre of it. So what I did, I started spraying. After spraying, they've completely gone. Now I'm replanting where they ate, which really depressed me so much.
Humphrey Lumbwe is the chairperson of Smallholder Farmers Association in Lusaka's Makeni area. He says the situation is really bad and the farmers are desperate.
And unfortunately, seed is rather expensive, and in the cooperatives that we belong to, the distribution has been rather delayed. So most of them are keeping their fingers crossed that probably government, with its intervention that it has introduced, they'll be able to benefit.
Francis Mlenga is a resident of Lusaka, one of the provinces hit by the pest, and is not happy with government's intervention measures so far. Initial reports of success in containing the damage can be misleading, and there are also far too many unknowns.
And I think we shouldn't claim that we have defeated them, but we are more worried because we are also concerned about the maturing of the seeds. Some of the seed, we don't know whether maize matures within 100 days. And I think we are talking about rain-fed maize, because if maize is largely the staple food of Zambia, and it is largely the one which was attacked, we need to look at situations where we can prepare for such disasters in future, as opposed to being reactive to issues. We need to be more proactive.
Patrick Lungu, another Lusaka resident, says the rise in maize prices over the past 1 month is worrying. A 25-kilogram bag of maize meal, which once cost $8, now changes hands for twice that amount.
There's need of a government to come in and intervene because this has affected the local Zambian, in the sense that a lot of households will go hungry, and which is not supposed to be the case, because as you are aware, we recorded a bumper harvest, and we don't expect such to happen.
But Agriculture Minister Emmanuel Chenda says the armyworms have been brought under control.
The situation has been contained very successfully. We don't have any armyworms, and we don't have any new reported cases. And farmers have gone back into the fields to replant, and whatever has been replanted is germinating very well, and the situation is now under control.
This is the second time armyworms have invaded maize crops in Zambia. In 1992, they struck in southern and central regions of the country and were followed the year after by locusts.
Kathy Sikombe reporting from Zambia's capital, Lusaka.
Get DW 24 hours a day. Our new round-the-clock English language TV channel is now on air. You'll find it on the KU band satellite SES5. For more details, please go online and check out www.dw.de/reception.
And still to come, why wealthy Nigerians are not traveling up country for New Year festivities.
Human rights.
This week's human rights story takes us to Cameroon, where journalists recently found themselves in the spotlight at a government-organized forum. It was convened ostensibly to bring order to the journalism profession, but for many media practitioners, the event was another ploy by the government to keep them under its grip. The forum was boycotted by some journalists' unions in the country after a long-serving minister and frontline supporter of President Paul Biya's regime, Jacques Fame Ndongo, was appointed chairman of the forum. From Yaounde, Moki Kinzeka reports.
These are the angry voices of Cameroonian journalists quarreling with the police for frustrating their efforts to stop the National Communication Forum, which was organized by the government to, quote, bring order into their profession. Among them is Kemanyang Paul, president of the Cameroon Commonwealth Journalist Association. I asked him why they were angry.
Why would the government come and form an association for us? Did the government form the lawyers' association? They sat down and agreed on their ethics and then forwarded their proposals to government. They made it abundantly clear that Cameroonian media is very irresponsible. They did not even say that some are irresponsible. They tag us as irresponsible people.
The reaction of the government was swift. The journalists were thrown out of the hall. Cameroon's communication minister, Issa Chiruma Bakari, told me why he took such an action.
Maybe they do not share the point of view of many others, but they don't have the right to stop it. His move was a failure.
The minister insisted that he wanted to bring others into the profession.
Each journalist has to exercise the profession without being a prey that politicians or other people can use in order to make the journalist as a tool.
For those not familiar with the media scene here, the relationship most Cameroonian journalists entertain with their public is not the best. They are accused of using the media to settle scores. Here's a selection of what people in the political capital, Yaoundé, think about journalists.
They have become tools in the hands of some public authorities who use them to attack those who are doing the right thing in order to achieve their selfish interests.
Some of them are not honest or dignified, do not respect the ethics of the profession, but the employer should be held responsible about 60%.
Some members of government create newspapers and use the men of the press to settle scores.
Some are good, some we don't even consider them as journalists. They are not of that fear, but they claim to be journalists.
However, some media practitioners in the country say the forum was a laudable initiative. The president of the Cameroon Union of Journalists, Charlene Dichia, told me that it at least made it clear who a journalist is.
The consensus once more was that to be a journalist in Cameroon, you must have a minimum of a university degree or the A-level certificate or its equivalent and must have worked for 3 years in the newsroom in order to qualify and be called a journalist.
One major criticism concerned the involvement of Professor Jacques Famdongo, who is a staunch supporter of the government of Cameroon, which is accused of withholding press freedom. He chaired the forum. Communication Minister Issa Chiruma Bakari does not see anything wrong with that.
All the resolution concern your profession and they will be equally implemented, equally apply to all of you. Professor Famindongo did a marvelous job. Indeed, your responsibility is to inform, to entertain, do this and that as other journalists.
But if someone else had chaired the forum, it would have given it a greater appearance of objectivity, which is the key principle in the world of journalism.
Moki Kinzeka in Yaoundé.
Listen to Africa Link where and when you want. Subscribe to our podcast and you will get the latest edition sent to you. Log on to mediacenter.dw.de/English/podcasts and look out for the Africa Link podcast. Africa Link, bringing you the story where and when you want it.
Hold up in Lagos. The end of the year is a time many Nigerians traditionally travel back to their towns and villages to celebrate the New Year holidays. But the rampant rising cases of kidnapping in Nigeria has changed all that. Many Nigerians, especially the wealthy and with celebrity status, are too scared to travel for fear of being kidnapped for ransom. According to a local newspaper, Nollywood actress Nkiru Sylvanus and former Mr. Nigeria Kenneth Okolie were recently both kidnapped in Oweri and were only released after large ransoms were paid. From Lagos, our correspondent Sam Olukoya reports.
It is mostly people from eastern Nigeria who are afraid of traveling home for the New Year holidays. That is the region with the highest rate of kidnapping in the country. There have been numerous cases of rich people and celebrities from eastern Nigeria being held hostage while on a trip home. Nigeria has the second largest film industry in the world, and most of the actors come from that troubled region. Faced with reports of frequent abductions, many actors have chosen to remain in cities where they work, like Lagos, rather than traveling home for the New Year holidays. Benedict Johnson is one of several Lagos-based actors from eastern Nigeria.
Well, the happenings in Nigeria is making it a little bit difficult for we, the artists, to freely travel at will. You understand? Because, one, when you're traveling, you need a lot of security to be sure that this traveling you're traveling, you will definitely return. You understand? Like, I am from the East. In the East, they believe that as an artist, if they capture you, people are there to pay. So every artist will be scared of traveling. Because, one, you don't know what's going to happen. When they kidnap you, you might be hurt, and you might not come out alive.
Notable people kidnapped in the past days in different parts of Nigeria include an actress, the mother of a minister, a Frenchman, four Koreans, and two Nigerians working with them. Although some of the victims have been released, it is believed their freedom only came after the kidnappers collected a ransom. Kidnappers in Nigeria are believed to make millions of dollars annually in ransom money. Dr. Sofirijua Peterside of the University of Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta region says the huge return from kidnapping is making the crime attractive to an increasing number of Nigerians.
And so because people are taken hostage and somebody is very willing to begin to pay, so the business thrives. It becomes an industry. It's in fact what I call the violent economy, the violence economy. So it has come to stay as an economy because every day more groups are emerging, splinter groups are emerging to occupy what I call the grievance space.
Not only is kidnapping on the increase in Nigeria, the kidnappers themselves are becoming better armed, judging by the weapons the police recover from them. Anambra State Police Commissioner Bala Nasarawa explains what they found in possession of a known kidnapper in eastern Nigeria.
The following arms and ammunition were recovered from an underground armory in his house: 27 AK 47 rifles, two type 06 rifles, one general purpose machine gun, one rocket launcher, 17 rockets, 13 rocket grenades. Grand total of ammunition recovered were 14,425 rounds of live ammunition.
The police commissioner said the arrest of kidnappers and the recovery of arms was an indication of police efforts to rid Nigeria of the crime. But Nigerians who are too scared to travel home for the Christmas and New Year holidays believe a lot has still to be done before their country is free of kidnappers.
That report was compiled by Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
USA.
And this week's USA comes from John Mann and is now read by Abubakar Jallo.
As a former U.S. Peace Corps volunteer who served in Niger from 88 to 91, I found your story regarding the Tuaregs of Ifurune full of hope in the Sahara of West Africa.
John was referring to a story we recently aired on peace efforts by Tuaregs in Niger, and now here's a sample of the story.
We got the idea of this peace forums because we do not want a repeat of the Tuareg rebellions.
A sample from the Tuaregs in Niger report. John was obviously touched by the story.
Please seek out more stories of hope and courage. The world needs to know, especially in the US, what is really happening in the world. Your story regarding the efforts of a few to avert conflict and war provided hope. I was inspired.
Thank you very much, John, for your feedback. We always appreciate to hear from you, the listener. And just to remind you that Africa Link covers such positive and inspiring stories every Tuesday in our Africa on the Move and Making a Difference slots. And now a reminder of some of the stories we have covered for you in this edition of Africa Link. Sudan has opened its second new oil field in a week as the country struggles to make up for the loss of billions of dollars in oil revenues lost when South Sudan seceded. And Zambia's maize crop is under threat following an outbreak of armyworms. The worms have destroyed crops in several districts of Southern Province. Rising incidents of kidnapping for ransom are preventing wealthy Nigerians from travelling upcountry during the festive season. And there we end this edition of Africa Link. For your comments and suggestions, our email is feedback.africa info@dw.de. Our postal address, Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany. We'll be with you on Monday, and from me, Crispin Mwakideu, have a pleasant weekend.